lecture is rhetorical argument, and I thought it was an interesting topic because it's redundant, because what argument is not rhetorical? Then again, not all rhetoric is necessarily argumentative, so the topic does point to some connection between what I have my PhD in, which is rhetorical theory and criticism, and argumentation in general, and of course the specific practice of debate. So that's what mostly the subject of this lecture is about, except I also noticed another meaning of the phrase rhetorical argument that I thought maybe was indicated by the planners of the Institute, and that's to mean something called an enthymeme, which is an argument, like a logical argument or a syllogism that leaves one of the key premises out, and the audience sort of fills that premise in their mind. And so that's another example of it, but in either case, it's really the same thing in general, and that's why I have that thing as my central idea at the top of the page I just handed out. Rhetorical argument requires the audience to participate in its own persuasion. So, if it's in that sense of the phrase where it's an argument with one of the steps missing, then the audience has to fill it in so they're participating, or if it's just rhetorical theory more generally, it's very audience-based, and it's sort of a study of how to get audiences to be persuaded of whatever you want. Okay, so what I'd like to do, I think you guys made it, all right. Cool. You only missed the first part. Did you miss that part or not? Did you hear it?
Does anybody like crab? Because I'd rather for him being lunch. It's cold, but it's good.
I'll hear with you later, but let's hear the lunch.
Yeah, okay, we'll catch up to the crab guy later. So a rhetorical argument is argument that requires the, just as a way of understanding it, I think it's it points to the idea that it requires the audience to participate in its own persuasion, and it also points to some connections with a broader field called rhetoric or rhetorical theory that might have something to say for you as studiers of argument and debate. Make sense? Okay. Just as an example, I just thought of something today. We walk into a restaurant, you know, at 5:45 or still, actually it was more like 5:30. We asked the waitress, or actually the host at the front, yeah, can you please hurry it up for us? Because we'd like to get out of here in time for a 7 o'clock event. And so that's all we said. That was our claim to their action, that they would be here. That was our proposition for them. We didn't have the debate or anything. We asked them. We thought they would do it for us. But then if that audience participated in it in some way, what premises or other things might they fill in to sort of change the intent of our argument?
Yes or no.
They might, yeah, agree or not, yeah, but what also might they fill in as associated meanings that might attach to or entail be entailed by what we said? Here in Vermont, a bunch of crazy guys, they don't look like they come here from Vermont, and they ask this question, how are they going to characterize that question in their mind?
Tourists.
It's terse? Or wait, what?
We're tourists.
We're tourists, yeah, so they might fill in that premise. Any other ideas?
Extremely picky.
They thought we were picky, right? In general, we might say they might fill in any number of premises for us about that would probably have negative connotation. So we're a bunch of jerks that just walked into the restaurant. Do you think the claim was going to be in our favor? Were they going to do what we asked them?
Depends how big your party
is. Well, we had a pretty big party, and I think they decided that we were rude and we should have made that request because we sat there for 20 minutes before we got a single thing. And then we sat there with our coleslaw for another 20 minutes before we got the next course. So it's an example of where the audience might participate in its own persuasion, but it might be its dissuasion away from your intended method. So you've got to keep that in mind, that participation might be contrary to what your intended strategy was. Go ahead.
Well, no.
Okay.
Service everywhere.
Yes.
I think you're trying to, from that particular example, you get in fact there were 9 people, mm-hmm. and it typically,
9 coleslaws? That took 20 minutes.
It's individually prepared.
So we've lived in Sean's fantasy world, that argument is a good example. Okay.
I'm there.
All right, let's talk about, I'm actually going to go in order. I was going to go out of order because I thought we'd be waiting on about 10 people, but it looks like everyone's here now. So let's just talk about rhetorical argument as a phrase, define it by example. Socrates is a man, all men are mortal, therefore Socrates is mortal. That's a classic example. Almost everyone's heard that about 20 million times. It's an example of a syllogism, right? It's the first thing, one of the first things you might study in a logic class to help you understand all the different A equals B, B has some character, then therefore B equals C, or whatever they're going to teach you in a logic class. That's like a logical argument or a syllogistic argument. Now a rhetorical argument, that same rhetorical argument just leaves out the middle step. and that would be called an enthymeme, but there's no reason to use that word because it just confuses you. Rhetorical argument is the audience is participating, in this case, is participating by sort of in their mind filling in the gap. Does that make sense? All men are mortal. They have to sort of believe that or fill that in, and that makes it like a little bit of cognitive energy is expended in the audience, and they fill it in. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. So you don't actually need to explicitly state that. So that's one example of a rhetorical argument where the audience fills in some connection or a premise. Another example is the audience might have some experience, like say it was a disaster. The audience had experienced something like happened in Atlanta, where, you know, I don't know if there was actual carelessness going on, but that's the whole thing about it. Somebody went crazy and shot a bunch of people. So if you were to make an argument before the audience that was in that community, some of the survivors in that community, they might be ready to believe a lot of arguments that you ought be risk averse. You ought be really, really careful about how you treat people. And you ought to be really careful about stock day trading in particular. You know, you don't have to do a lot of work to convince that audience because they've already participated in their own persuasion. They've already done a lot of your work for you. That makes it a rhetorical argument as opposed to just a straightforward logical argument or something like that. Still another example, just this is a classic one, probably should have came first, a rhetorical question. Operates the same way as that first example where an audience can just ask a question. So what is rhetoric? And then some audiences might have some connections and they say, oh yeah, it's buffoonery or snooty language that's designed to deceive or something like that. And they're thinking that, and then you answer the question for them, but meanwhile they'd already participated and they thought they knew the answer, and then they compare the answer that they might have almost come up with to your question and then what your real answer was. And so you've gotten the audience to expend a lot more energy than had you just started talking. Does that make sense? So they're participating in that case, not a persuasive example, but an instructive example. And I guess that sort of assumes instruction is a persuasive endeavor, which it is. You have to persuade students to learn anything. So that's a good example. And the last thing, experiential learning in general. I worked at the Experiential Learning Center, and it uses as its pedagogy this idea that if you get audiences to participate in learning certain concepts, they really learn it in their heart. Like it just their body knows it. Does that make sense? So has anybody ever done a ropes course? One of the things they try to teach you at a ropes course, it really is a persuasive thing. They're trying to persuade you that trust is an interesting thing, or that it's important to trust other people, and they're trying to persuade you that it's worthwhile to experience this thing called trusting other people. So one of the things they did to me when I was in a ropes course is they asked you to stand way up high on something and just kind of fall back and land in the arms of people. And so then you know physically in your body that what it feels like to actually trust other people. And so then you think, well, yeah, maybe trust isn't such a simple concept, and it's not something you can just dismiss as something you shouldn't think about or be careful about. And then you learn, wow, it is kind of more, there's more to it than that. And you learn that physically in your body. So that's a rhetorical argument for the importance of trust, and it happened so quickly. But all it had to do was they had to do that physical action, and then they were able to do that. Another example is in business courses or decision-making courses, sometimes we just want to teach this basic idea that group decision-making sometimes or oftentimes is more effective than individual decision-making. So we'll split everyone up into groups, but each individual in each group will do a little survey or make a decision on ranking some items at a complex problem, like a survival problem. Has anybody done a survival exercise like that? Yeah, and then they'll put you in groups, and then you work out some kind of a consensus decision-making form, and then you find out, whoa, the group answers turn out to be much more in line with what the experts say, and you're much more likely to have survived in the scenario or to get the best benefit or whatever the game happened to be. So it's another way where experience really taught you the truth, the value of what they were claiming. And so just to summarize, in general, it's the idea that mental energy is expended by the audience and you'll get better at it over time. You can try to manipulate that. Get audiences to spend energy, and then you have some degree of power over them. Does that make sense? Or power with respect to them and what they think and what they're likely to be persuaded by. Okay, so and for example, say they supply some premise, they apply their experience, they supply a belief or something like that, and you can use that. So it's a resource for you in a debate, perhaps, if you can figure out what kind of energy is being expended by the audience, and you can steer their attention towards spending certain kinds of energy. This is a big project, I know it's a tall order, but if you just use it once, it'll pay off, and the next time it'll be easier, and you'll be surprised over the years or over the months, you'll be able to start getting a feel for some of the ways you can get audiences to go where you want them to go and to see things the way you want them to see it, instead of hoping that the formulas you're using are just going to be the same formula as the audience is going to expect. Instead of hoping that your mastery of the various diverse conventions in the community are going to work, you can sort of have more of a psychological grasp of how audiences really do work, and what needs to be said and what doesn't need to be said to sort of steer their attention. So having said that, are there any questions so far before we move on to my second sort of area of analysis? A lot of looks on your face saying, what the heck is the relevance of this to debate? And it, like I said,
elaborate a little bit on what you would diagnose as far as people's energy, like maybe your energy level as a speaker, or just...
Well, if you're trying to say, you're trying to persuade somebody, if you get them, by virtue of something you do, to spend mental energy, even if it's just a little bit of energy, like just to make a connection or to get the joke,
okay.
It satisfies some cognitive or emotional desire on their part, and you've used some power over them. And once you've had power over someone's mind a little bit, they might jump on the next one a lot easier. And then if you build them up, get them to agree to a lot of things, like this is a classic example of that. Some classic sort of motivational speakers will tell you how to do this. You get them to agree to a few things, yes, 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 and then there is all this mental energy moving in the direction of agreeing with you, and then the next thing you say might be a very challenging point, and they'll say yes to that too. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And that's trading on the power of rhetoric. And that's what I think I would go on to next, talking about the field of rhetoric. You may not understand that it is a field, and it's a pretty large field, although it's not large in numbers of people who study it. It's been around a long time, and it covers a lot of ground. So if it seems like I'm going to cover a lot of ground in this lecture, it's kind of silly, actually, to try to cover the field of rhetoric in one topic. But just to give you, I just want to touch on a couple things that you can maybe use over time in debates, and also show you a way to organize your study of argumentation and rhetorical theory so that it doesn't seem so overwhelming. Okay? So just those examples to give you an idea of the power of rhetoric and how it relates to mental energy and getting control over people's attention. Now let's talk about what rhetoric is. In general, the study of rhetoric is concerned with probable knowledge. If we were studying a certain knowledge, we might be studying something else, like physics or logic, because logic is concerned with what necessarily is true based on the preceding premises that you've agreed to or something like that. So it's mathematical necessity. You might be studying math if you're studying something that is studying certain knowledge. But rhetoric is concerned with uncertain matters about human belief and things like the quality of life and stuff like that. Does that make sense? It's that field where we look for ways to decide what to believe, even though we don't have enough grounds to believe it. Okay. Another characteristic of the study of rhetoric is it's concerned with symbols. Sometimes people forget about this. Symbols in the human world, and it's concerned with that and its effect. Those are the effects of those things on people. What John was talking about, I think it was today, earlier. Seems like yesterday. A long time ago. He was talking about language and how you can use language as a refutation strategy. Well, a lot of that trades on this idea, on a concern of the field of rhetoric, which is that language has effects, and the symbols that language creates for you have effects, and they are important. And you can draw attention to the consequences of various kinds of symbols and how you use them. Okay, that's another sort of characteristic of the study of rhetoric. It's concerned with the strategic use of that language. That's another thing about it. And then finally, the most important thing, if you want to know what the scope of the study of rhetoric as a field is that it's concerned with process as opposed to content. Do you understand that distinction? If you're studying economics, you're studying a field that has a certain content. If you're studying biology, you're studying organic matter or living things or things like that. In rhetoric, you might be studying biology too. You might write your dissertation on the history of argument about a certain biological construct. I've read articles on how they argued in the DNA model the first time it was proposed in a scientific article. It's concerned with the process. Its content is the process of argument or persuasion across all fields. Does that mean that makes sense? I think I wrote down in the notes I handed you that it's omnidisciplinary. That means every discipline might be something you would be studying in rhetoric because you're trying to figure out
a dissertation on education.
Yeah. Like, so the content of my dissertation was rhetoric, but I had to put it in a certain context to sort of understand, to make it easier to digest in one book like that, right? So I did a dissertation on school reform, but really it was about rhetoric and argumentation, sort of the underlying agenda that I had there. And it was about the process of debate about school reform. I could have done the same dissertation on the process of public debate about the environment or any number of other topics, and it's just commonplace for people to narrow their rhetoric dissertations into a certain controversial context or something like that. And that's the key thing. That's why people aren't even aware that rhetoric is a field, because it's a field that you could be concerned with in any other field. There's a book called The Rhetoric of Economics. There's a whole movement called The Rhetoric of Inquiry. Just there's probably articles and things on the rhetoric of argumentation, just the field of argumentation and what it buys and what it doesn't buy in terms of the conventions of that academic community. So having said that, let's talk about a couple of definitions of rhetoric. My favorite one is that first one on the second page. The rhetoric is the economics of human attention. Remember how I was talking about the yes, 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 and then they're likely to say yes to something they might not have said yes to before unless you built it up? Because their attention was directed toward agreeing with you. And that's why I like that, because I was an economics major, and Richard Brandom has this rhetoric is the economics of human attention. Human attention is in short supply. Only about a third of you, are paying attention right now, you know? Like, it's in short supply, and more of you paying attention than that, actually, but, you know, it's in short supply, and what you get people to pay attention to is consequential for what their behaviors are going to be, and what you can get them to do for you, and what you can get them to believe in terms of your credibility and your message and things like that. So it's in short supply, and that's what you study when you're studying rhetoric, is how to get them to pay attention to what you want them to pay attention to, and then if you want them to pay attention, for instance, to issues of democracy and community and things like that, and the role that symbols and strategic language use play in that, you're studying in the field of rhetoric. Huge field, but it also has some pretty useful theoretical models that you can apply to debate. Aristotle just defines rhetoric as a faculty that you can use. How you discover how to persuade people in any given case. So that's how he outlines his whole book on rhetoric. It's just looking at it as something where it's your ability to discern in any given case what are your tools that you can use to persuade people. And so it's not easy to just do that. You don't automatically know all the resources available to you that you can draw on to persuade people. But, you know, if you study the art of rhetoric or you've been trained in it, and that's what you do in debate, you learn a little bit more about what's available to you for persuasion. The last definition of rhetoric is kind of interesting from Wayne Booth. He highlights the idea that you're trying to get together when you're studying rhetoric. You're trying to study how people could possibly be on the same page. I have all of you on the same page just using a little trick. It's not a rhetorical trick, you're just looking at it. You're all there reading it. That's why I got you on the same page. It's an easy rhetorical trick. But in general, there's skeptical people believe that it's difficult for human beings to be on the same page. We're not on the same page. We're just really in different worlds. And you might think you're really close to people and you're part of this close-knit community and you all believe the same thing, and then suddenly some disaster will happen, or not even a disaster, just some little dissociation will happen, and you realize just how much strangers are around you, even if you thought they were really close. So Wayne Booth has his definition of rhetoric, highlights that problem that he's concerned with. He's concerned with how we come together to achieve some level of truth together, that we can share some agreement towards something. Does that make sense? It's kind of a tall order, but just those are three of the most important definitions of rhetoric. Now, just for practical matters of how to use rhetoric in debate. The first way, I think, you can use it for useful models and things like that. One of the things that you can be aware of is this idea of figures of speech. And there are hundreds of them, and we'll talk about metaphor in particular, I think maybe tomorrow or Wednesday. But in general, you realize that figures of speech aren't always just decorative sort of fluff on the Christmas tree of discourse, right? That in fact, not only do they figure or shape your speech and make it look pretty, but they actually figure the minds of your audience. And that's sort of an insight in rhetoric. And if you study the figures of speech with that in mind, it'll help you generate arguments. Because we do have a bias in our culture that we're looking for arguments and ideas and content. We're not interested in beauty and pleasant sounding voices and things like that. That was actually a big concern throughout some parts of history, because it wasn't allowed that you would have new ideas, for instance, or question God or anything like that. So all the rhetorics at that time were concerned with beautiful language and ornate language and decorative language and things like that. But now we're concerned with just about anything. So be aware that figures of speech, like metaphor, shape your thinking and what's possible to think. Just like those metaphors that John was using for conceptualizing debate. Debate is theater. That's a metaphor, and that's going to generate what's possible for you to even think about debate. So the figures of speech are actually really figures of thought. Things like motivation are pretty key in rhetorical theory. If you just do a little reading in rhetorical theory, think about what they're saying about motivation and human motives and how you can, and what's likely to happen, what's likely to motivate people. and even those basic public speaking text sort of ideas about audience analysis trade on this. What do older people are likely to think about your message? What are young college kids who are busy and tired and hungover likely to think about your message in that speech class at 8 a.m. on Monday? Just basic analysis like that about human motivation is sort of within the field of rhetoric, and that's the field you would turn to if you want to find out about that. I think the most important thing is that last point I have on that page is that I think you can use those canons of rhetoric as a model for just organizing things if you feel ever overwhelmed by the amount of material that's available in even a debate camp or something like that. And it's an old model that's been around forever, and some people don't even use it consciously anymore. They just it's become such part of our discourse that we forget where it came from, just like Dewey's reflective thinking sequences have become part of our discourse, and it's part of our habit. You have a problem and you look for solutions to the problem, you test the solutions and then you publish the solution or whatever other version of that basic Deweyan model you have. We forget that it came from John Dewey. But the canons are invention. How you discover, sometimes Aristotle calls it discovery because he acts as if everything's already out there and you just find it, that you don't actually generate any new ideas or create creative things in the process of rhetoric. So just how do you discover them? Sometimes the only method anybody in our educational system has come up with about that part of rhetoric, how to generate ideas, is brainstorming. And it's this mythical thing that the teachers tell you how to do. Just start writing everything down that comes to your mind on the paper. And that's a method of invention, and sometimes it comes up with interesting things. And don't kick it out, but just realize there are a lot of other methods of invention, and a lot of what we focus on at this institute are dealing with methods of invention. And a lot of what is also focused on in debate training is arrangement, that second one. How do you arrange your ideas once you've come up with them? What do you put first, what do you put last, those basic issues. And then there's style, memory, and delivery. So what you can use that model, it's from rhetoric, and that's kind of the last thing I had to say about it, is you can use that model to sort of help you package what you're studying so that you don't feel like you're trying to grasp it all at once. Does that make sense? You might be, it's pretty overwhelming, especially if you have 5 lectures in a row. You feel you can't get it all in your head at once. And you just package it some way, it might be a little easier to digest. So what have we studied so far, do you think? Have we studied anything to do with invention? And then there's arrangement.
Research with invention.
Yeah, research is a big part of rhetorical invention, especially for an on-topic debate community like the other half of this institute right now. What they can discover about arguments is going to happen from their reading and not research. So research is one method of invention. It's like brainstorming, isn't it? It's a big part of it. What other methods of invention? Discovering arguments. Remember, that's what it is. What have we taught you about discovering arguments? Just even today, what did John tell you about how to discover arguments against the case? He said, remember that?
Yeah, the whole ways to go through points.
He had those four-part model. It's a really great model for discovering arguments. If you didn't have that model, you wouldn't know where those arguments came from. See what I mean? So he's offering you in that lecture another method of discovering arguments in a particular context. Is there anything about arrangement that we discussed?
Tolman a little bit.
Yes, can we talk about structure? What did you just say, Don?
So yeah, Tolman as a kind of arrangement, but it's also invention.
You talk about Tolman?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's another interesting question. Is sometimes these models that we teach that are ways to discover arguments are handled by students and even some coaches as just arrangement things, arrangement models. And Kuhlman, his idea was to use that model to discover interesting things to say about arguments in general, and then people have used it to arrange a paper about an argument and stuff like that. You can use a lot of inventional models to arrange a speech, and sometimes that makes sense, that to the topics of the model really lend themselves to a nice, recognizable structure for a speech. We studied style or memory at all? What's our method of teaching delivery?
It's really experiential.
You have a lot of practice and stuff like that. You might have some other things to say about it.
The style and the feedback we're getting. Style.
Yeah. I don't think I'm going to get it all down in here, but just to give you an idea. You might notice where you've been erring in terms of all your study has been about how different ways to structure speeches, and it hasn't really helped you with some of the topics that have been mentioned or things like that. Some of the more heavy-duty theoretical stuff is about discovery or invention. And then a lot of times memory doesn't even handle that very well, except we try to stay under arrangement, make it a simple structure so you can remember it. I had a debate round, I judged the second one today, to debate without a flow, and they were really aware of how they had to structure things in order to remember what they were going to say. If they depended on the flow, it didn't matter, they could be sloppy. But as soon as they weren't going to have their flow, boy, they were tight. Whew, structure. So, any questions so far?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, well, it makes the delivery a little better, actually, if you have a better form like that. And it's easy to when you get away from the flow, your arrangement is a lot more simple, your style seems a lot more natural, it seems a lot easier to follow, everything about it improves. That's not always a good idea in some communities, right? Because you might drop an argument. But at the same time, it's not difficult to remember all the key sort of stock issues in a case that are happening. You might miss one example, but hopefully that's not enough to outweigh the big substantive issues that you're talking about. Are there any questions so far? It's kind of a big topic, and so I handled it in such a brief way that I'm running out of stuff, and I was hoping we dig into some part of it.
Is there a difference between communication and rhetoric? And rhetoric's concerned with results?
Rhetoric is concerned with the effects of symbols on human beings. It's not necessarily the results. You're more concerned with results when you're in a debate or in a particular context. But you might study rhetoric just to how do people achieve community or what happens accidentally by virtue of how we talk about certain groups of people. That's been a big part of the field of rhetoric, and it just actually branched off into a whole other field called cultural studies. Right? That's about how different discourses and ideological structures have real political consequences in the world in terms of excluding certain voices from the discussion and things like that. John?
Well, I wanted to mention something that you spoke about earlier, mm-hmm. because I think it will help everyone in the debates they have here and in future debates. And that's the issue about the connection that one makes with the judge. This is an important part of winning a debate, is to establish a connection between your ideas and the judge. And why is it important, and how can you emphasize its importance in a debate? What we more frequently describe as judge adaptation, I think, is what Sean's describing as a rhetorical appeal of inclusion mm-hmm. for the judge. And judge adaptation, the way most people describe it as judges, is to say, well, I'll show up at a debate, and then you're expected to adapt to me. And that's all the judge says. Well, in what way can you adapt to a stranger? You have no knowledge about most of the judges who will be examining your debate. What sort of expectations do they set when they say, you should adapt to me? And I think these are the ways in which one can meaningfully adapt to judges so that you can use this as a way of winning debates. First, I think you need to appreciate the idea of difference. That people are not the same as you. They don't view the world the same way you do. And so it's important to have inclusive examples and rhetoric to make sure that you touch the world of the other. And this is one way of connecting your ideas with the judge. Secondly, I think you want to do what Sean suggested, which is convert the judge from a passive listener to an active listener. The judge must be a participant in the discussion. And so creative thought, inspirational presentation are ways in which you transform the judge from being a passive observer of the debate to an active participant in the debate. And the third thing that I want to mention is that you need to establish an ego stake for the judge in your ideas. In other words, you connect with the judge and you have agreement. And it's the other side in the debate that is outside of the discussion. You and the judge connect, you're in on the joke. This is done very effectively by Bill Murray in his movies. Bill Murray's character isn't part of the movie so much as he's also part of the audience. He's connecting with the audience, he's winking at the audience. He's chuckling with the audience about the other characters in the movie. He's making a joke about the other characters, and sometimes that includes his own character, but connecting with the audience about it, this is the way in which you bring the judge in on your side. And so I think you want to establish that kind of agreement with the judge. Then the judge has an ego stake in what you say. After all, you're in agreement. And the judge views you as the representative of the judge's ideas in the debate. You can do this by inclusive rhetoric. You can also do this by creating ideas that the judge cannot resist. So the better your argument, so that the judge cannot answer that with their own independent voice, the more likely they are to align with you in the debate against the interests of your opponent. How many of the experienced debaters here have had this happen to them in tournaments? At the end of the debate, a judge might vote for you, but might vote against you, and as they give the reasons for decision, the judge talks about issues that were not part of the debate. And they explain the judgment by saying, you should have talked about this issue. Or, here's another issue that I thought of during preparation time. And all they're trying to do is connect their ideas with a representative in the debate. Have you had this experience for people who've been in debates? I think everybody who's been in debates, in parliamentary debate in particular, has had this experience with judges. Well, this is the way in which you try to establish agreement with the judge. Now, you are the voice of the judge. And the judge sits there in opposition with the other team. And I think that's the way in which you can use rhetoric to empower your position in the debate relative to your opponents. And as I've mentioned to you a couple of times already, debate's not about truth-seeking. We're not going to find the universal wisdom on any idea based on what we do in a 45-minute debate. But we will be able to advantage-seek. We will be able to find a small truth about the proposition. And so I think that's what you're trying to do, and you're trying to include the judge as part of your project.
Excellent. Are there any questions? Not, because sometimes two parts of an argument might have been made, and if a third part was really key but wasn't expressed by someone, they might get credit for it from the judge. Maybe they shouldn't, and in fact I tend to agree they probably shouldn't get credit for it, but they might get credit for it, so you should never feel surprised when something that you had clean cold turns out not in your favor, because you never know exactly what associations of the language that the other team used and what language you used were reacted to by the judge's mind. If you're just going for it willy-nilly, you never know where you're steering the attention of that person. And so then that just keep it simple. You want to be friends with the judge for that case. You use like he said, inclusive rhetoric. You and I know this is true. You know you never would make a decision without considering this issue. And then the judge will nod their head. As soon as they nod your head, you got them. They're never going to buy an argument against that one. You know, and you can do that. You can get them to buy arguments that even just because you made them nod their head. You know what I mean? And just not to be surprised about that either.